Tēnā koutou katoa, no mai haere mai ki te Indigenous Urbanism, Aotearoa Edition, Episode 17. I'm your host Jay Kake, and this is Indigenous Urbanism, stories about the spaces we inhabit and the community drivers and practitioners who are shaping those environments and decolonizing through design. On this episode of Indigenous Urbanism, we speak to Daniel Glenn, an architect from the Crow Tribe of Montana, who leads a firm based in Seattle, Washington, specializing in culturally and environmentally responsive architecture and planning. Do you want to start by just telling us who you are and what you do?
Yeah, I'm Daniel Glenn. I'm an architect based in Seattle now, originally from Montana, the Crow Reservation. The Crow, we call ourselves Apsalaga in our language. I've really been focusing on tribal work for most parts of my career, starting very young. My current firm is called Seven Directions Architects and Planners. We're a small firm, and we're working with tribes around our region in Washington, but also we have projects in California. We have a new one in Alabama. So we're working in many parts of what we call Indian country in the United States, primarily.
What brings you here to Aotearoa today?
Well, this is my second trip. I was invited here 2 years ago to be part of this first Indigenous design conference, and I was quite surprised, actually, the first time I got the invitation. I didn't know anything about this place, or, you know, I thought the only thing I knew about New Zealand was, you know, Whale Rider and the Maori, which was one of my kids' favorite movies. And I remember when I first met you, I thought, wow, you look like the girl in Whale Rider. Yeah, but I thought, oh, that would be great. And I wasn't quite sure how they found me, but I agreed to come and came with my partner, Valerie. I was just taken by the place and by the people. And I guess the significant thing was when I came here, I thought it would be an exciting trip. I would meet some interesting people. I would see some things. But I honestly didn't see how it would resonate directly with what I do, because it's such a different culture, a different place. And I think that's been the biggest revelation, is that the Maori are a colonized people, just like my own tribe and North American Native Americans and First Nation peoples, and we share so many similar challenges and experiences, and also, I think, opportunities with the power of these cultures that we work within and are part of. Because of that, I want to keep that relationship going and keep that connection, and was very delighted to come back for the second annual.
Yeah, I felt similarly when I saw your work, as you were talking about your process of working with communities and the kind of things that were important to them and the kind of buildings and environments that were being developed as a result. There's a lot of similarities with what we're trying to do and what we are doing. And so that was kind of a surprise, because again, I mean, we have the same context of colonization, but the cultures are quite different. But it's been really affirming, I think, as we've started developing this community and seeing the ways that we can support one another. Really cool. So yeah, it's great to see you here again.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I would say there's more affinity. I've seen, now that I work on the Pacific Coast, you know, there's more direct affinity culturally in some respects with Maori, in terms of, in comparison to where I'm from. You know, we're a buffalo people and horse people. And so we don't have this strong connection to the sea, and like the whole, in the Salish where we're working with, they have the canoe journey and the strong connection to the canoe culture, and even the longhouse has real similar relationships to the whare here, and you know, and the way the marae is set up resonates with the communities I'm working with. You know, I do see some cultural parallels, but certainly very distinct in so many other ways.
So I was really fortunate to come and visit you at your place last year. So we had a small group go on a bit of a study tour around Seattle and then onward to Vancouver to see Patrick, and then over to Ottawa for the symposium where we all gathered. Now, when we were with you in Seattle, we had an amazing whirlwind 2 days, I think it was, and we saw a great many things. But I wondered if we could talk about maybe some of those projects.
Yeah, let's see. I think we started with the Puyallup, the place of hidden waters. Yeah, so it was exciting for me to be able to have visitors, you know, come all the way from New Zealand and to bring them to that community. And when I told, you know, talked to the tribe and said that you might be coming, they were excited about it too, you know. And if you recall Annette Bryan, who's now a council member of the Puyallup tribe, she was our client when we designed the building as the head of the housing authority. So she, you know, welcomed your delegation in a beautiful ceremony, which I was very happy to have that happen while you're there, because I always feel like we can't ever match, you know, ourselves, the welcome that we receive here, you know, but they welcomed you with song and drums, and so I'm glad that happened. And I'm glad you got to see in person some, you know, because I'd shown the film that certainly your viewers are welcome to see on, there's a short clip of the Place of Hidden Waters that, so you can actually kind of see what, where we were. So I'm curious to hear your impressions in person, because you saw it on film and then, you know, you saw it in person. What did you take away from that?
Yeah, so I think the way it was designed really resonated with us around how we plan our papakāinga, which usually involves housing alongside other communal facilities integrated with the landscape as well. There's a community center at the middle, which I believe was a like a basketball gymnasium or something,
it was
and it's
an
been
old
extended.
Gymnasium that was just almost defunct. I mean, it was a concrete block structure and had been built there to serve a youth home that was on the site for troubled youth that had been there. And then that was adjacent to 27 townhomes that were also sort of, they were still occupied and everything, but there's a lot of issues in the community with crime and with drugs and challenges that they were facing when we started the project. So yeah, the communities, we went through a process, and one of the key questions at the beginning was, what do we do with that old gym? You know, do we keep it? Do we take it down? And then actually what we came to was we realized, wait a minute, you know, this is, the gym is, first of all, it's a solid structure, you know, it's large, and we analyzed it economically, it made sense to keep it. But also we realized that traditionally in the Salish culture, when they would expand a longhouse, they just extend it longer and make an additional space for additional families, sometimes up to like fifth of a mile or more of longhouse. So we took that idea and expanded it by extending it out and creating that whole sort of living room, as we thought of it, for the eventually 47 units that we created there.
So. And those units, they're a mixture of different sizes?
Yeah, so the original development has 2 and 3 bedroom townhomes and some fours. So when we designed this, one of the needs that they had was housing for elders, seniors in the community. And so in our process, we determined that there was not a desire on the part of the elders to be isolated, like to have just the elders' community and then the families. So we developed this typology that kind of came about, you know, from the program, but also studying the archetype, which is what we often like to begin with, you know, studying the tradition of the tribe, and in that case, this, the longhouse or plank house structure, which in that region was a shed, single slope roof. And when we were analyzing that, we realized that there was many ways that we could manipulate that structure, that form. But in section, it worked to sort of get at that form. We found that if we had one side one story and the other side two story, we could create that overall concept of the longhouse. And so that gave us the opportunity on the one side to have flats that are for elders, fully accessible. And then on the other side, two-story townhomes for families. So it's a mix, and then they share this long gathering space in the middle that's akin to the longhouse itself. So historically, those structures had shared central long spaces that had fires along them, and each family had a fire in the middle, and then they had their sleeping spaces on platforms that were elevated, and they used woven mats to create privacy. So we took that idea of the of those sleeping spaces and in a modern context made those into homes, so townhouses with the central common semi-covered open space. So yeah, it was a mix of multi-generational housing, which is something that we like to do, and it's reflecting the needs of these communities that we work with. And so we ended up building, each building has 10 units in it, 5 elders, 5 families. We built 2 of these structures, so there's 20 altogether, and then the 27 we renovated and improved. So it's a 47-unit community with the community center at the heart, which includes now a refurbished gymnasium and a gathering space. And so, and then the other key part of it was that it's adjacent to a forest that is a slope down to the Puget Sound. Because they're salmon people and they're very protective of the water, that was a big challenge of how to make this place in a way that would not disrupt the or hurt, harm the waters that were there. So we went through we worked very closely with our landscape architect and our civil engineers to create a landscape that all the water is dealt with through rain gardens that you saw. We walked around and took a walk through the forest. So we preserved 2/3 of the site as forested land.
That project, that reservation land, it's in a kind of an urban area. Were there any kind of unique challenges or opportunities with being in more of an urban setting?
Well, what's interesting is that the Puyallup peoples were, their homeland was essentially built on top of the city of Tacoma, which is based on the word Tahoma, which the Puyallup refer to the Mount Tahoma, which is called Mount Rainier. And Mount Rainier, as Tahoma, is considered sort of the mother of the Puyallup people and the people of that region. So that community is, you know, even though it's a forested setting near the water, it's actually in the suburbs of the city of Tacoma. And all the land around them is non-native land. So what the tribe has been buying or holding parcels kind of scattered all over the city. And that was one of these smaller parcels. So initially, when it was interesting, when we went back there, Annette Bryan was talking about how the homes across the lots across the street were empty when we built. And there was a lot of concern among the neighborhood at, you know, about that development. And like they considered it a, you know, bringing down the property values for all the white families. But when we rebuilt this and created this community and the, you know, it transformed the place in many different ways. Apparently property values went way up. And so right across the street, they built new homes and they're like, you know, $500,000 houses, you know.
So it's self-gentrifying by accident just because the quality was too good.
Well, but but what's unfortunate was that the tribe, had they had the opportunity, I'm sure they would have done it, would have bought those vacant parcels, you know, prior to the development, so that, yeah. So it's true. I mean, there was some level, but the irony is that you would never imagine that a low-income native community would be a gentrifier anyway. But it is considered, you know, beautiful by the people around and it, you know, so I guess it's had that impact.
Yeah. Well, the next place I think we went was it Skokomish Reservation.
Yeah.
And we went to see the new community center that was under construction, which I hear has opened late last year.
Yep.
Do you want to tell us a bit more about that project?
Yeah, so another tribe in the region, this one's further south of Puget Sound. It's on the very end of, it's called the Hood Canal. It's west of Olympia in Washington. Skokomish Reservation, it's a relatively isolated community. It's a small fishing community, fishing and shellfish gathering community. And they've been doing that for thousands of years, and they're still doing it. It's still the primary income of the tribe. And it was quite a challenge initially, you know, coming from the outside into this little community. They're very reserved and a little, you know, understandably nervous about outsiders in general, you know, and I'm sure you're familiar with the process of the early engagement and getting to know everyone, and relationship building is fundamental to what we do and having that strong connection. But it was a process we had to go through. What we initially were asked to do a master plan because the rivers, the Skokomish River, that flows into the Sound has been disrupted by all the development and the way it's been affected by that. It's actually started to have, you know, quite a flooding issue. So even though they've been in this area for millennia, their particular area where their homes are and their facilities are getting flooded on a regular basis. So a key part of the project was to move from that lowland up to higher ground. And we designed a master plan that includes a new tribal administration building and a new clinic and a forestry department and their police station and, you know, all of this. As well, at the heart of it, they wanted a community center. And so the community center was phase one. And as you saw, a key part of the project at the end was a strong integration of the artists. We were very excited and impressed to learn that there's so many significant and talented artists among the Skokomish people, similar to the Maori here.
It was interesting for our group because after we went to see the building, we went and visited the carver at his whare.
Yeah.
And in his garage, which is his carving studio.
John's.
There's a tino flag hanging up. And we're like, oh, who gave you that? So yeah, so I forget who it was, but he obviously
Rungi yeah. Kippa.
Oh, who's here? Okay,
yeah. this world is extraordinarily small. So Rungi has been, when I first came here 2 years ago, I realized it. I met Rungi when we were on our tour around the North Island. We went to his studio. In fact, he made this for me. I forget the hook, how we say it in Maori. I got this at his studio, and we connected because, you know, he knew John Edward Smith, who we were working with already on some of the early concepts around the carvings that would go in that building. And so Rungi had been there, and now I've been there twice as an artist in resident, working with John Smith and several other Skokomish and Salish carvers in the region on a project. It's called the Basket House, or the Fabric Arts Studio for Evergreen College. And we're not the architects for that. One of my indigenous colleagues, John Paul Jones, designed that. And we visited as well the longhouse there that he designed. And so it's amazing that the Basket House is a Maori and Salish collaboration. And it includes carvings from both traditions, and John was talking about how Rungi was teaching him all these techniques, and it's affecting his carving and his approach.
It was so amazing to hear, actually, and we were like, wow, the carvers are about 8 years ahead of us. That's all right, we'll get there.
You mean in terms of collaboration?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, I was astounded. And I mean, that keeps happening. Like, we have a Squaxin Island tribal member here, and, you know, it seems so far away, and yet there's all these strong connections. And I know that what I've learned is that the Salish communities and other tribes I've worked with, the Talawa in Northern California, have been here. There's a real strong admiration and desire to learn from the Maori in our communities, because we feel you're way ahead of the game in terms of your political power in community, and also your very strong focus on the language and keeping the culture strong. So for us, we come here to learn from you, you know, and try to understand how you're doing all this. And so many tribes are doing that, not just our community.
Yeah, I think it's been a really nice reciprocal process too, because I think often there's the assumption that Māori are further ahead in a lot of things just because of our political status, but actually there's a lot of things where we're way behind. And so I've done a lot of work in housing, so it was really fantastic to go and see housing projects over in Canada and the US and see that actually there's some really innovative models and things that are a lot better than anything we've been able to achieve yet. So a lot to learn from each other.
Well, I'm really curious. I know you went out in the middle of what I consider the middle of nowhere on the in New Mexico to see the Naizi House, which is we designed with, when I was at Arizona State University, I was a faculty running a center there, a design center. Back in 2005, we designed and built that home as a model house. I'm really curious to hear what you thought. It was quite a journey. I was impressed that you went all the way there.
So we went on a wild journey where we saw Joseph and Nathaniel and so on in Phoenix and visited some projects. And we drove through the desert through to Farmington.
Oh, man.
Spent the night. So I was the driver.
And you went in the night?
No, it was all through the day.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's beautiful.
And we stopped in the Painted Desert.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful road trip. And the landscape was so amazing because each time you would sort of go a little further and it would change quite drastically. It's nothing like what we have here. Anyway, so it was a phenomenal experience. And then we drove from Farmington to Ngezi and went to see the whānau there and visit them at their home. Yeah, it was amazing to be able to visit someone on Navajo Nation and actually kind of see how they live and spend time with the family. And so they just showed us around their house and talked about it. And it's funny because I feel like you get a different perspective when you just spend time with the residents of places rather than the architects. So they were kind of funny because they were, first they just raved about all the things they loved, and then they were quite honest about the things that didn't quite work.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, so it was really cool when, you know, how there's the sort of, what, the courtyard?
The courtyard, yeah.
And he's like, oh, do you want to see something cool? And he like opened all of the sort of doors and things. So, because the cross.
Yeah, ventilation and the light as well. We designed it that way.
And then the structure, I'm sorry I'm a bit ignorant of the name, but the structure that's over the courtyard that sort of.
It's based on the Hogan, which is the traditional home of the Navajo. And Mary, who you met, grew up in a Hogan right near there. It's actually her husband, Key Augustine, who sadly passed away just a few years ago. But we designed it for those two elders and their family. But they both grew up in Hogans. In fact, Key did not speak English at all. When we were designing that project, fortunately we had Navajo students of architecture on our team. So, and I speak Spanish, and Key speaks Spanish and Diné, but not English. So we would interact with him that way. Mary, who taught school, she speaks English, as you know, talking with her. And it's delightful to me that she's still living there, and that, you know, it's, I mean, that was 13 years ago now, and you know, it's heartening for us that when we do this kind of work, you know, it's, and she's had visitors from literally all over the world. I mean, you weren't the first to arrive from.
No, we got that sense.
Did she say that? Yeah.
No, but we were welcomed very warmly into their home.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Her and her son Jimmy, who's right next door.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The funniest story about that project was we designed it to be, you know, as low energy as possible, and we. With the orientation, and passive solar, and all of that. And then we used a material called Navajo Flexcrete, which was just being developed by the Navajo Nation. And I'm actually on the board now of Navajo Flexcrete, a volunteer member to help them. And that particular project was the very first Navajo Flexcrete house built by the tribe.
Have there been many others since
then? Yes, since then they've built hundreds of other homes, not unfortunately as culturally responsive. You know, a lot of them have been more conventional. There's been some that have had, you know, other aspects to them, but energy-wise they have a similar performance and quite extraordinary. You know, it's a challenge we found dealing with any institution of transitioning, because they'd all always built out of stick frame, which in the desert is crazy to build out of stick frame. It's terrible environmentally, in terms of it doesn't have any mass, so you can't use it for passive solar.
What did they do before that?
Well, the home that Mary and Key lived in was a wood frame structure. It was built in the 1960s, and it was it had black mold in the house. It was heated by a single wood stove.
Are these had homes?
That particular one was built in the 60s with dollars from HUD and from through the tribal housing authority. So we call them HUD homes.
So we were saying that the homes built in the, you know, 50s and 60s.
Yeah, so those were typically built in wood frame. Actually, the 60s, 70s, 80s, all the way up till now, you know, they were. That was kind of the standard thing. And I sort of grew up in an office that we were doing work, you know, with through my father's office. And we even did work in Arizona. And so the homes that at that time were, you know, the plans and everything were essentially dictated by Washington, D.C. So
standard.
The tribes had no say. And even as architects, we had very little say. We had to just sort of locate them in different locations. And they were not climactically responsive. They were culturally responsive. That particular house by this point was in great decay, you know, and they had done a lot of additions, and, you know, there was kind of pieced together. And when the students, Navajo students of architecture, approached us, they had talked about the idea of renovating that house. We were working with a student named Christopher Billy, who's now a photographer, but he was an architecture student at that time. From that area. So he approached us, our center, and said, you know, he was interested in us helping him out some way, and that he had kind of a waiting list of people that needed homes. And So we went and visited that site. You know, they had talked about renovating it, but we said this is not a renovatable project. So we had to, you know, discuss the idea of tearing it down and rebuilding it on the old slab that was there. And it was interesting when we, the elders, the family agreed to the whole thing, and then, but then we had to run it by the council, which was in the chapter house nearby there in Aizy. I don't know if you went to their chapter house.
We drove past.
Yeah. We presented what we were going to do, and it was really interesting because there was this sort of a murmur and stuff in the crowd, and it was all in Diné, so I had no idea what they were talking about. But they seemed kind of upset, and we didn't know what was going on. And then we, you know, I'm like, what's happening here? And it turned out that a few years earlier, there'd been a Christian missionary group that had been working in that area, and they had volunteered to help somebody with their house, and they basically tore out a whole bunch of stuff, the kitchen, everything, and then they were going to make it all better and improve it. They got only like halfway done, and then they had to leave, like their time was out, and they just left. And so, you know, this poor family was left with this kind of
ruins of a house.
So there was a lot of skepticism, and you know, sadly in Indian country and in our communities, we, that kind of thing isn't uncommon, so people are very
justifiably
skeptical. So we had to, you know, I had to get up and make this whole speech about we're with Arizona State University, and you know, we have the backing of the university, and we would never, you know, if we tear this house down, we're building you a new house, and all
building
of
that trust.
Yeah, it was a challenge. And so they believed us, fortunately, and it was largely, I think, due not to us, but to the students that we had working with us, you know, because they were, had that trust, you know, they had that connection. And so we proceeded and we built the home, and it was part of this larger effort to promote the use of, you know, this new material, this aerated concrete, which most in Europe, it's very common, but very uncommon in the United States. Wood in the desert there, you know, it gets eaten by termites. It has no benefit from, you know, to help the houses keep cool, so they're overheating, or you're using huge amounts of air conditioning or heating. In the, as you recall, you're at 6,000 feet on a mesa, so it snows and is very cold in the winter, and in the summer it's like hot desert, 100 degrees. So, you know, for us, when we designed there, we did a energy model of the home. I was working with Ernesto Fonseca, who's a Mexican architect who at the time was a graduate student there working for us. So his thesis was actually on that house, and he did a whole monitoring of it and analyzed it and wrote a paper on it. He put all these sensors throughout the home for a year, and then as we, you know, as we built it, we put these sensors in, and then we monitored it remotely from Phoenix. That was what I was going to mention, was that at some point we had this big spike in energy, and we were like, what is going on there, you know?
Give them a call?
Yeah, no, we actually went out there. Oh. We were like, well, what's going on? We thought there was some problem. And it was so funny, because we get to the site. There literally was a very long extension cord going from Mary's house to one of the other son on the other side. So there's Jimmy and Kenny on either side, and they live on either side of the home because it's their allotted land. So the family lives there, and they had somebody hadn't like paid the bill or whatever for the power, so they were using the power from that house to keep their house going.
That would have thrown at you, that.
Yeah, but it also showed, I think, something fundamental that we learned there was, I mean, first of all, this beautiful, it's like a family compound. It's not like her adult sons live on either side of her, and they have this land. And that's why I think this idea of permanence is critical, and that we design for the very long term. But also, you know, they support each other. Like you saw, you know, they're helping Mary now. She's getting quite old. And, there's a very strong spiritual aspect. When we initially designed the home, talked about the Hogan, and do they want, you know, just sort of a modern version of the Hogan? Does it make sense? And they wanted a connection to the Hogan, but they didn't want to go back to living in the Hogan. They've been living in a more conventional house with bedrooms and, you know, privacy and a different sense of, you know, a Hogan is a single circular space. It's very much like a yurt, you know, and there's apparently some potential links to that, you know, because the Navajo are actually Athabascan. They speak the same language as the Athabascans up in northern Alaska.
Oh, wow.
And so they have a very direct connection over the, you know, the land bridge and all of that historically. And so that language has migrated all the way down. And what's ironic is now we're working with the Talawa in Northern California, and they're also speak, they call themselves the Dene, and they speak the Diné language as well, which is Athabascan. So these connections we're constantly finding as we work with different tribes. And one thing I would love to hear your thoughts on was that part of our goal is that when we design, you know, for different tribes, is that we're designing for that tribe, for that place. And so I'd like to hear your thoughts of how you felt, you know, comparing the two, like going among the Navajo to this Puyallup and the different buildings and how they're designed to each. I mean, did you see that?
Yeah, I really enjoyed kind of getting to understand some of these more traditional typologies and how that thinking has carried through to create contemporary models. Because that's a real focus of kind of my approach too, is thinking about what is the best of how we used to live in the past? What are we hearing from the way our elders lived? What is our land telling us? And then how can we take the best of new technology and knowledge and information to adapt to our current context to create new ways of living? And I think that those concepts are really exemplified in those projects that you've shown us.
Great. I mean, that's really a key thing for us, is this notion of tribal specificity and regional specificity, responding to each climate, each culture, each place in a very distinct way, and building off of those traditions, but, you know, not being afraid at all to embrace modern technologies like this aerated concrete or the SIPS panels that we built the Puyallup home out of, the townhomes there, which is also part of the indigenous tradition of embracing, you know, things as they come, like the canvas, I mean, from buffalo hide to canvas, you know, for our teepee lodges. You know, it's a transition that we make as we gain new access to different materials, or going from quill work to bead work, because we had quill, you know, all the bead work we see in North America was not traditional. It was quill work with dyed quills that were woven. But when the Europeans came, we started utilizing beads that we were able to get from.
Well, and acknowledging that our cultures have always been adaptive and embracing of technology and able to evolve, mm-hmm. and knowing that we don't want to live in a museum piece.
Exactly. That's right.
Our people don't want that.
Yeah, and that was very important for us to learn, you know, talking to these elders, because, you know, they might have grown up in a hogan and they love the hogan and they use the hogan now as a spiritual place, you know, that particular family, and or in their sheep camps. Like many Navajo have sheep camps up in, even the students we were working with, the Navajo students spent their summers in the sheep camps with their grandparents in hogans. So they're still living in them, which is beautiful, the tradition. We don't, like our teepee lodges are, we only camp in them like powwows and gatherings, but it's not like a, it's primarily ceremonial, and, you know, it's not somewhere we actually live. But the hogan is a living home still. But there's also this desire to, you know, have Wi-Fi and have, you know, all of the other things that modern living affords, but still embracing and celebrating and being strongly connected to our cultures.
One final question. The theme of the podcast is Indigenous urbanism and the way our Indigenous communities are shaping their physical environment. So did you have any final thoughts?
Well, we're actually in the process of trying to learn again from your communities, like the experience in Auckland with the Maori design principles that are being put in place there. And we're very interested in trying to bring similar approaches to decolonizing our cities. In the United States, the majority now of the Native community lives in cities. Part of that was by design. In the 50s and 60s, there was a whole effort to get people off the reservation and move them to cities. And so there was this big internal migration. You know, myself now as an urban Indian living in Seattle, Washington, far from my traditional land, you know, connecting with all these, there's many different tribes living in Seattle and places like that. And so there's two things there. You know, it's the challenge of creating places that are, feel like home for urban Indians, and dealing with, you know, the challenges like homelessness, which is significant. The Native community is the highest representative population of homeless in Seattle. So, but also having an impact on the city as a whole, and saying, you know, how do we demonstrate and celebrate, make a strong presence of that Salish culture that's been there for thousands of years and has largely been erased by the settlement process. And So I think that that's something, it's a part of our job, you know, in our own communities, is bringing that voice back to our cities and having that presence. And what I have, when I've met with the city of Seattle and planning leadership and talked about this, it's a challenge because planners think of in numbers, like they're whoever shouts the loudest. So it's by, if you have a majority of people, that's who tends to get listened to. And we don't have those numbers. So there's very small numbers in urban comparatively to the larger majority population. So what I try to talk about is that we don't have numbers, but we have centuries and millennia of time. So this notion of the weight of time, that presence sort of supersedes the small numbers that we currently have, and say, how can we bring that, the power of that 10,000 years or 15,000 years of presence to the forefront in our cities? And I think it will profoundly affect not only the indigenous communities, but it, for the Pakia people in our communities, the idea that, you know, it's a wonderful thing that they'll know that they're in a special, unique place, and that's part of what gives it uniqueness and moves beyond the sort of sameness, this kind of overriding sameness of consumer colonial culture spaces. And colonial spaces.
You can find out more about Daniel's work at sevendirectionsarchitects.com. This episode was recorded on location at Ngā Te Kore, the second International Indigenous Designers Hui, hosted by Ngā Ahu in March 2018. Indigenous Urbanism is a production of Te Matapihi. Sandy Wakefield does our sound recording, editing, and mixing. Our theme was composed by Thomas Burton. I'm Jake Kake, your host and executive producer. For more information about today's show and other episodes of Indigenous Urbanism, go to indigenousurbanism.net. You can drop us a line at info@indigenousurbanism.net. And if you like what you're hearing, please give us a review or rating on iTunes. Coming up next on Indigenous Urbanism, we travel to Porirua to learn about Imagining Decolonized Cities, a project designed to stimulate discussion around what our cities could look, feel, sound, taste, and smell like if they were decolonized.
People understand Māori-ness to be a rural thing. It's not an urban thing. It's not something that's relevant to the city, and that's problematic in two ways. First of all, it kind of dismisses the mana of the iwi and hapu for whom these places are theirs. It means that their identities aren't represented well in the built environment. The second thing is really about a sort of general kind of erasure of indigeneity in the built environment.